Within the deepest recesses of the darkest corners, in the dingiest of libraries, on refectory tables, within dens of debauchery, places of erudition, libraries, bookstores, bedrooms, living rooms, motel rooms, majestic halls illuminated by dim light bulbs, these 21 lip blockers did read again. Five nominees, 21 lip blockers, the Lit Blog Co-op.
Five
nominees and a blackjack to peruse their innards. Ladies and gentlemen, readers of all deviant persuasions, including vanilla, please join us as we momentarily preempt Mr. Segundo the next round of the LBC Podcast. Okay, I am here with Derek Badman, who nominated Jean-Philippe Tissot's television as his nominee. So, Derek, maybe you could tell us about how you found this book and why you nominated it.
Well, I originally found it. It's actually one of the first books I read in French. I started learning to read French.
Oh, really?
And I read Camus' The Stranger, because that's the one everyone reads first, because it's easy. And I just went into a library and was looking at contemporary fiction, and for some reason we had this one copy of one of his books. And it sounded interesting, so I ended up taking my dictionary, and I read the book, and I really liked it. I've actually read it about two other times now, and I really like Tucson. It's very interesting.
Now, seeing as how I'm about to talk with Jordan Stump, the translator, I was wondering if you, if his translation kind of lived up to your experience of reading this in French.
Yeah, it did surprisingly. He really captures the voice of the narrator. Mm-hmm. At least how I heard it with my rather rudimentary French reading. But I didn't make any direct comparisons, but it read the way I expected it to.
What was it about the protagonist that sort of, you know, kind of struck your fancy with this tale?
I think the Jim Jarmusch comparison is very apt, because he's one of my favorite film directors. Mm-hmm. So that kind of everyday, aimless, wandering kind of concept is what really attracted me to the book. And the narrator particularly, he's just very funny and almost kind of deluded. Like, you get so much focus through him that you can kind of see the irony of his situation the way Tucson tells you.
Well, the strange thing about reading this book, for me anyway, was that it almost felt like reading a Jacques Tati film.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you got that sense. It was very odd, because a lot of the comedy in this book is very visual or very situational based, which I found to be kind of interesting.
It's that French humor.
Yeah, it's the French humor, but, you know, this is a lot funnier than Jerry Lewis, that's for sure.
I do like Tati. And I do. One of the things that really attracted me to the book was the humor. I don't usually read a lot of funny books. So, like Raymond Cano, he's very funny, and I love him. So reading something that was humorous and also very intelligent and not overly dramatic was a very nice change. It's one of the things I really like about these films.
You've been burdened with too many dramatic, intense books, or?
I don't know. It's the serious novels. So maybe I'm misrepresenting. I mean, William Gaddis is very funny. Gilbert Sorrentino is very funny.
Yeah.
So it's all that kind of dark humor in a way.
Okay. Well, Derek, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, so I am here with Jordan Stump, who is the translator of Tissot's television, which is the LBC finalist. Jordan, how you doing?
Okay, great. How are you?
Pretty good. A little harried here, but I'm glad we can make this happen.
Me too.
So I wanted to go ahead and talk with you before we actually get into television. What steps? I have no idea how to translate anything, and I'm just maybe curious to, you know, I've never talked with a translator. Perhaps you can tell me exactly what your method is.
Yeah, it's every translator I would imagine that you talk to will give you a different answer to this. But the way I do it is actually I think back to Nick Lowe, the old the record producer in the late 70s, and his motto was "Slam it down, tart it up." And so that's essentially what I do. I always do a first draft very, very, very quickly, very bad, and without having to worry too much about whether it's any good or not. hand, just to have something in front of me that I can work with. So once I've got a rough draft, I then go back and start revising again and again and again. And there are many steps. First, I revise without looking at the book at all, and then I often go back and the original, I mean, and then often I revise a second time without looking at the original, and then I start comparing to the original, see if I've revised too much, if I've made things too different as I was trying to make it clearer. Eventually, I have my wife, Eleanor Harden, read my translation along, read my translation to me, and then I follow along in French, a way of making sure that, you know, I'm not dropping sentences, and that, again, I haven't strayed too far from the original in my translation, and then also I depend a great deal on her ear to tell me what sounds right, what, you know, what works. It's really important in a translation to have somebody read it who not only hasn't read the original, but preferably doesn't even know French. Because it's very easy to translate a sentence and you think it means something because you remember what the original sentence was, whereas somebody who doesn't have that experience, it won't mean anything too. And so there's a sort of a long process of negotiation there where she suggests this, I do that, sometimes it makes me think of something else, etc. Then I go back and revise it again. And the end translation, for me, is really simply a question of revising again and again. And at all times asking yourself, does this sound like something like the narrator of this book would say? Sometimes that's fairly easy, sometimes it's quite difficult. And does it sound like something he would say, he or she, and to what degree does it work as a text by itself? Eventually, once you get to the end, you read the translation and you feel like it's something. You know, you feel like it sounds like something as opposed to something that was, as opposed to an attempt at making something. It sounds like a text that one could read.
Well, with an author like Toussaint, I suppose it must be particularly more difficult than usual because he has a very comic and idiosyncratic tone to his particular writing. What steps did you take to sort of, I guess, as a translator, I suppose you must have to come to terms with a certain style of your own while also preserving another author's style. What did you do for Toussaint?
Yeah, he was actually very difficult, and I sort of didn't think that he would be, and he turned out to be quite difficult because, you know, he does have this slightly detached, deadpan, somewhat, just ever so slightly, over-careful, particularly in this book, in television, this is, after all, a university professor who's writing. It's just an ever so slight, not pompousness, but formality to the writing, even as there are these continual little jokes that come in the parentheses, etc. And so the hard thing there is to not turn it into a writing which is simply stuffy, mm-hmm. and which is simply sounds academic. I mean, you've got to get the curious nature of this guy, who is an intellectual in the end, but not a careerist. That's obvious. And so how do you get that across? And again, I mean, the solution for me was simply to keep looking back again and again at what I was writing and thinking, does that sound like this guy? In a way, usually what I do is meet with every author I translate. And one of the questions I ask them is, what word can you give me that would tell me what this book is supposed to sound like? Huh. You know, what impression is the tone of the narrator supposed to make on the reader's mind? What adjective would describe that? And writers can be helpful in different ways about that. I mean, one guy told me that the narrator was supposed to sound tired, and hard to know exactly what that means, but I did my best. With Toussaint, I didn't get a chance to meet him until after I'd done the translation, but we did write back and forth a bit, and he speaks English more or less, but still not so well as to be able to tell you what's a good phrasing, what's a bad phrasing. So I was sort of on my own there, and now that I've sort of met him, because his books are always, to one degree or another, vaguely autobiographical, mm-hmm. now that I've met him, I sort of feel more confident that the tone of the translation is actually right. And it's funny that happened. I guess that's a testament to the quality of his writing, you know, that he can get his voice across, even when he's talking about a character, even his narrator is not himself at all.
Well, going back to what you were sort of mentioning earlier about sort of, you know, finding the particular tone, I mean, something like, for example, the library scene in this book, which is utterly hilarious, but I mean, did you kind of work on these scenes in long chunks, or how did you kind of affect it so that it has a particular sort of, you know, you have the beats that are there in the translation, and I don't speak or read French, unfortunately, which is why I can't talk to Toussaint. But nevertheless, though, you know, I mean, something like that, did you work heavily with Toussaint to sort of, like, you know, make sure that the beats were kind of retained, or were sort of the beats, you know, irrespective of what language it was in, they were kind of already there?
To some degree, I mean, you're right. The idea of beats is a really good one, because the beats are very, very definitely there in French. If they don't fall quite as they do in English, simply by nature of the language. French can handle much longer sentences than English can. In this book, I sort of tried to keep the sentences vaguely longish and winding in the way that his are, but there is a limit that you can go beyond in French and not in English after which it gets awkward. But you're right, that the idea of beats is really there. And so that's why hearing the translation read aloud is really helpful, because you've got to hear that in your as you're reading, it has to sound good spoken aloud in order to read well on the page, I think. And so for any author, that idea of the sort of rhythm of the sentence is really important, and keep it short when it should be short, etc. And so again, it's a matter of paying close attention to the original at the right time, and then at another right time of simply not paying any attention to the original at all, and let the beats work in English as everything else. Let it work in English regardless of exactly how it's done in French. So the idea of the beats were there, and the sort of phenomenon was there, but the French passage actually doesn't have quite the rhythm that the English one does.
Gotcha. Now, I was wondering, did you consult any other sort of translations as a guide for television, or...
Not so much. I read a lot of translations, and that's always sort of useful as a way of seeing how other people do things. But yeah, there are translators who will try to find say an English or an American text which is vaguely equivalent in terms of tone or whatever to the text that's being translated. And so you read that, and then that's sort of supposed to, you know, get you in the mood and into the rhythm, etc. I don't do that so much because, well, it's not all that easy to find an analog to Toussaint in English, I don't think. And furthermore, I don't know, in a sense, I want it to be right for this book, and everything has to happen within this book, and so I just let my instincts, I guess, guide me in terms of how it works inside this particular book.
Mm-hmm. Now, did Dahlke approach you, or did you kind of pitch them, or how did that exactly happen? How did you guys get hooked up?
Yeah, it's kind of complicated, because I've been reading Toussaint for many, many years, and I loved his novels. And I've always thought, you know, at some point I'm going to translate one. And I kept having other projects that sort of took me away from it, et cetera. And then, so I was sort of, vaguely had in my mind that I was going to do a Toussaint book and possibly this one. And then purely by accident, well, not exactly by accident, but out of the blue, Dahlke wrote me and said, would you be interested in doing this? I think it was Warren Motti, who's a great scholar of contemporary French literature, who had suggested that they might contact me about this. And obviously, the moment that they wrote me, I leapt on it. This is a chance that I'd been waiting for many years.
Now, how long does it generally take you to sort of translate a book? It seems to me that the actual process would be almost just as painstaking as actually writing a novel.
I think in many ways it's got to be fairly close to that. I have, essentially, it takes me as long to translate a book as the publisher will give me. And in some cases, that can be short. I did a Jules Verne novel for Random House.
Yeah.
It's like 600 pages, and they gave me 8 months, and that was absolute murder. I was teaching at the same time, and oh, it's just murder. It was horrible. I would never try to never do that again. This book, I think they actually gave me the year. It's a much shorter book, but you know, that year I used up that whole year making it ride. Translation is one of those things that, you know, if I didn't have a deadline, I imagine that I could still go back and revise it more and make it better. But eventually you do have deadlines, thank God.
Well, you know, we're talking about deadlines here for both this book and also the Jules Verne adaptation, or translation rather, adaptation, it's interesting. Did you find that there were things that you didn't accomplish because you didn't have enough time, or you had to kind of let it go at some point? Maybe you could talk about that.
Yeah, not really. I usually feel like I'm obsessive enough that when I see a deadline coming, I drop everything else and do this one thing and think about that 24 hours a day. I mean, ideas for how to word a phrase sometimes come to me in the middle of the night. I wake up and I realize this is how you do it. And so, you know, eventually, by the time I turn it in, I usually feel very, very confident about it. Now, that said, if you actually go back and look at your old work, you will inevitably find sentences, phrases, where you think, why didn't I say this? There's the obvious solution. It was right there in front of my face, and I didn't see it. And, you know, people say, never go back and look at your old translations. But actually, I do it as a way of well, it builds humility, for one thing, but kind of a reminder that you can never really find the absolutely perfect solution, and you've just got to keep trying. But yeah, no, I don't really feel like with either one of those books that I could have done more if I'd had more time. I think I'm pretty good generally at squeezing in as much as I can possibly do fairly quickly. So I hope that I'm justified in feeling that way.
Now, do you when you translate a book, or perhaps maybe we could talk about television, is there anything that you just can't possibly translate, that it's just untranslatable, that you have to drop? And how do you deal with a circumstance along those lines?
Yeah, there are inevitably untranslatable things. And I hate the idea of dropping them. I don't do that. Or at least, I hope I don't. There are some things, however, that you simply can't get across. And so there are various solutions to that. I mean, at one point in television, the narrator, he sees, I can't remember his name, the head of the foundation that gave him his grant.
Yeah.
He meets him in the swimming pool, and he says it was, whatever his name, me, M-I, with a grave accent on the I.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that is I had no faint idea what that meant, and so I actually wrote Toussaint and said, what is that? Turns out it's a Corsican expression. He has a summer house on Corsica, and mm-hmm. it's a Corsican expression, obviously, to express surprise. Well, what do you do? If it's Corsican, am I supposed to find, you know, something Mexican to put in, you know, or whatever, or Australian to put in instead? That would be silly. So I just leave it as it is, and that's one solution to untranslatable things. You simply leave it and don't worry about it. I don't much like that solution, but I think it's important in this case to leave the Corsican reference, because that's part of Toussaint's self, I guess. At other times, there are things that there's something you can't translate, but on the other hand, the thing that is lost there, you can put in somewhere else in the text. In other words, if there's a pun that simply won't come across, you could simply choose the solution of not translating that particular pun, but of making a similar pun somewhere else in the text, or even close by, so that you have, you know, what matters is not necessarily the pun itself, but rather the fact that this is a person who makes puns of a certain kind, intelligent, stupid, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so find your opportunity as a translator to put in a stupid or intelligent pun, so that even though on the level of the individual word or phrase, there is in fact something that has been lost, on the level of the text itself, that thing can be recuperated.
On the idiom front, how liberal are you in terms of, you know, do you try to sort of find a kind of English, a comparable English idiom, or do you essentially sort of like leave it as it is and kind of try to make it the least awkward phrase imaginable? Or
yeah, probably at different times I would do either one of those.
Mm-hmm.
My preference is to find an English idiom that works. If there isn't such a thing though, then you have to work with what you've got and make it so that it means something to an English speaker and doesn't stick out. You know, I hate it when you're reading along and then suddenly you see this thing that sticks out and you see, oh, that's a translated, I can tell that's a translated phrase, you know, and the translator didn't know what to do. And that's the thing that you try to avoid at all costs. In general, it's not all that hard in terms of idioms to find something that will work in English, even if it slightly alters the you know, the sense of the original. It's not necessarily that serious if it alters it in the right way.
Mm-hmm. Going back to this issue of beats, and you kept in sort of lengthy sentences, it would seem to me that the risk of that would be for an English reader to sort of, you know, an English reader is going to read a translated novel and say, why is this sentence so long? Do you think that something like that might sort of call attention to the fact that it's a translation, or where do you kind of split the difference?
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
People always blame the translator first. You know, if there's something about a book that looks odd to them and it's a translation, they always assume the translator has done something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so actually, you know, one of the preemptive responses to that is simply make sure that there isn't anything odd about the book at all. Make it so that it sounds like, you know, absolutely natural English that could have been written by somebody from Nebraska or whatever. And then, of course, the danger is, or the terrible thing is that you lose part of the idiosyncrasy of the original.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's a kind of a balance that you have to strike between a certain respect for the reader. I translate, for instance, Eric Chevillard, whose sentences are much, much, much longer, just horrifically long. That's part of the humor of the thing. And you've got to keep that. And reader be damned, you know, because that is supposed to matter. And so in my translation, it matters. But then at the same time, you've got to be thinking about the poor staff who's going to buy this book. And, you know, you want him or her to like it more or less. And so you've got to think, what will get across to this reader the idea? What will get across to the reader is the nature of this writer,
mm-hmm.
and we'll keep that nature, you know, entire and intact, while at the same time not giving the reader something that he or she will not be able to, will simply look at without any pleasure, and with that kind of suspicion that in this country particularly people always seem to feel about translations, and that's not always an easy thing, but. Once again, you've got to think, you know, you've got to think for the author, and you've got to think for the reader at the same time. And I guess probably just those two. You think of the author, and you think of the reader, and you somehow try to bring them together.
Well, the other thing, too, is that translators really, I think, get a bad rap. I mean, you know, anytime, like, a translated book wins an award, well, the author gets recognized, but the translator does not. I mean, how do you feel about this? I mean, what can we do to sort of, you know, tell people, look, there are these translators who are putting in all this extra effort, as much as a novelist.
Yeah.
You know, what do we do to sort of, you know, make you know, Translator Awareness Month?
Yeah, why not? Yeah, every translator has a million stories to tell about this. It's funny, if you actually get a review of one of your books, usually the translator is afforded precisely one adverb. Don't say, you know, smoothly translated, expertly translated, or awkwardly translated, or whatever. But you get one adverb. Essentially, that's your reward for doing the translation, which in a sense is fine because, you know, it is somebody else's book, and I don't mind it being somebody else's book. At the same time, another story. A different author told me, you know, I have such respect for translators. You work so hard, and it's all for somebody else's, you know, for somebody else's glory. And that's not exactly right. I work for my own glory. I really do. And when I come out with a good translation, I think, man, I'm a really, really smart guy. Nobody else may ever see that, but it makes me pleased with myself. And that's actually, but not only with myself, because I've also done something that has allowed this other book to exist in a way that it didn't before, to be available to people in a way that it wasn't before. And that's, you know, sort of serving the cause of literature or whatever. You know, that's a good thing. But it is funny that in this country, there is and in England to some extent, there is a really tremendous mistrust of translations. I was listening to the BBC a few months ago, and there was a show on about books, and this woman was saying, well, I don't read translations because I always feel like I'm not really getting the book itself. which is a completely ignorant thing to say. You know, that means that, you can't read Don Quixote or the Odyssey, you know? What's funny is that in Europe, people don't feel that way at all. People read translations all the time, and it doesn't bother them in any way. But here, I think we have such a... well, you know, there's the problem of the sort of general unawareness of the real world that we have in this country. But also, I think there's a feeling that English is such a, you know, special language that that a word can't be translated into it. You know, that if it comes from outside, then it cannot be said in English, because English is for native expressions only, which is a dumb attitude. And I don't really know how that got started, and I don't know what to do with it. The one thing that I wish people would, the one change that I would like to see in people's attitude toward translators is that they would see them less as hacks and more as guides to interesting reading. I mean, if you pick a translator, if you pick a translation, you know, you find a translation that you like, look at the translator. What's his name, his or her name? Look that person up on the internet. See what else they've translated. Since most translators translate only things that they really love, you may find that person will have done a lot of other books that are also interesting to you. I mean, I wish that people would sort of see translators as people who they can turn to when they're looking for other books that are like one that they've read and they like.
Well, I mean, at the same time, though, you mentioned Don Quixote, and the Edith Grossman translation really sort of, you know, made the rounds, and I guess maybe because it's a pre-existing classic. But, you know, why do you think there's this divide between classical sort of translations as opposed to, you know, people like Toussaint?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I would suppose that... if people have heard the name of a book enough times, I think there's a funny way in which they come to see it as part of their literature. In other words, Don Quixote is such a famous book, but it's essentially as if it were a part of American literature. The Odyssey as well. Obviously the Bible, you know, and a great many others. People see it as something which is not actually foreign, you know. I mean, it's a concept, Don Quixote, which is incorporated into our society. Toussaint, what is that? How do you say that? Who is this person? French, Belgian, I don't know where Belgium is, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's sort of, the contemporary novel is marked by foreignness anyway, simply by the fact that it's contemporary. But I think that foreign contemporary is, again, curiously, seems a lot more foreign than foreign classic to us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes any sense.
No. It totally does. But I guess, you know, because we're dealing with a situation in which, like, there are, as we were kind of establishing, any number of books that are not even translated to English that are out there that we will that, you know, that I, as a sort of, as a monoglot, you know, will never ever know about.
Oh, it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. You know, in Europe, I saw the numbers a long time ago, and I can't remember what they are, but the difference is absolutely phenomenal in the numbers of translations published in, not just in France, but all over Europe, and the numbers published here. Here, it's tiny. I mean, in terms of contemporary French fiction, I don't know how many translations come out in a year, 20, something like that, you know, 30, 40, but in any case, a very, very small number. And that is indeed a very sad thing. You have to, you know, get down on your knees and thank whomever for people like Donkey Archive, who really are interested in... putting out their stuff, which is worth being seen, regardless of whether it's necessarily going to make them a lot of money. Big commercial presses, obviously, are stuck in the rut that says that everything has to bring in X amount of money. And alas, a lot of the really interesting things that are out there are simply not going to happen with. And I mean, it should, but it doesn't. And so, yeah, it's particularly lately, I've been having a very frustrating time writing to various publishing houses saying, look, here's this really great book. You should translate it. And they say, no, not interested, because it's, you know, it's just not, this person had a translation published earlier and it didn't sell well, therefore this one's not going to sell well, and so the hell with it. And those people have to make a living, and I understand that, but it is doing a tremendous harm to America's understanding of what else is going going on in the world.
Well, aside from the commercialism, there's also this interesting idea. You had mentioned, like, you know, oh, I had always wanted to translate Toussaint. And to a certain extent, actually, it seems to me that much of what does get translated falls upon the translator's interests or passions or likes. And what if they're incompatible with, say, like, you know, a really literary person's take? I mean, how there might be a certain sort of discrepancy. I mean, in fact, maybe you as a translator might have a certain kind of advantage that, you know, other people don't.
Yeah, it's certainly true, you know, and you're right that things, a lot depends on the person's taste. There are, you know, there are people, and I'm thinking of, for instance, Linda Coverdale, who's a really good translator of contemporary fiction, who has very, very Catholic, small c, taste. I mean, she does a variety of completely different kinds of texts. It's really admirable. I tend to translate, you know, a certain kind of contemporary fiction because it's the kind that I like. She's much more open to a vast, diverse range of styles of writing, etc. It depends on the taste of the translator. It depends on the taste of the people at the publishing house. And it's one of those situations which is obviously not going to be perfect. We can't possibly publish in this country a translation of every book that's ever published all over the rest of the world, clearly. And so one is stuck in this situation where you get what you can, and there is something sad about that. I mean, obviously one could always learn French and German and Italian, and Spanish, and I mean, the list starts to get long.
Yeah.
Japanese. So, highly imperfect situation.
Well, there's also the issue of, like, okay, let's say that there is a, you know, a major French experimental author that, you know, well, the vast American populace or the vast UK populace or the English-speaking populace doesn't know about. If commercial interests are, you know, the guiding factor, I mean, you know, do you feel that this is a problem where there, you know, you're almost kind of, you kind of need to play it safe to a certain degree, since there are only a limited number of slots to translate? You know?
Yeah, I mean, who needs to play it safe? You mean the publisher or the...
Well, the publisher, and to a certain extent, you know, if someone approaches you and say, hey, Jordan, you know, what's a good sort of book to translate, or is there anything that you would like to translate, you know, that is also kind of commercially viable?
Oh, and so, yeah, right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, in theory, this is one reason why, as a professor, I have a certain kind of advantage over a commercial translator, because a commercial translator, by which I mean a professional translator, if that's how they make their living, essentially they have to be having jobs lined up all the time, you know.
Sure.
Whereas I can wait and do only the books that I really want to do. And so, for instance, experimental stuff of various kinds, I myself don't play it safe. If there's a book that I like, I try to sell it to a lot of different publishers. Now, the publishers, on the other hand, do tend to play it safe and tell me, no, this isn't interesting. Once again, Docky Archive I'm working on a translation now for Docky Archive by an experimental writer from the late 60s. His book is from the late 60s, Jean-Louis Gardou. Nobody even reads him in France anymore. He's just been completely forgotten. And this is a wonderful book that has been forgotten by everyone, essentially, except for a small number of specialists. And I would never, ever be able to get this book published with a big commercial publishing house. But there are people like Donkey Archive, Archipelago Books is another one, Sun and Moon, who have taken the risk of putting out stuff that's interesting simply because it's interesting, and hope that they make money off, you know, enough money off that, or make enough money off something else that it counterbalances it, etc. But you know, there are people doing it, but they're few and far between.
Well, aside from Ricardou, are there any, now that we have you on the phone, are there any other authors that you feel are just being criminally not translated that, you know, that the English-speaking, you know, English-reading public deserves to sort of read?
Yeah, I think that, let's see, there's a guy, Patrick Modiano has been writing since the late 60s and is still writing really wonderful novels. He's had a couple of his novels translated. I did one. There were a couple of others that were translated in England. But, you know, Modiano is a really odd case because he is a major, major, major star in France. Every one of his books is immediately a bestseller. But, you know, they're not not potboilers. He is a really interesting, fascinating, haunting, funny, troubling, incredibly intelligent and moving writer. And his success in France is very well deserved. And in this country, for some reason, Modiano just can't get arrested.
Hmm.
You know, they put out a book of his, and it falls off the map. And so, for that reason, yeah, people are playing it safe, and he's not getting translated much anymore. And but I think it is really only three or four of his 20 novels that have been translated. And so there's one I think that really deserves, a jillion times more attention than he's actually gotten. There are contemporary writers, too, much younger. I'm thinking of a guy like Igor Grand, I-E-G-O-R-G-R-A-N,
mm-hmm.
Very funny. Contemporary writer, actually of Russian nationality, but came to France, and he's a really wonderful, delightful writer. And so far, nobody has picked up one of his books. I'm hoping to do that myself soon. And then there are other ones. I mean, again, among the sort of the younger set, Nathalie Canton has only published. Well, she's published actually five or six books, I think, and is really a great, funny writer, and has yet to be picked up. But even among the people from the generation of Toussaint, people like Jacques Serena, for instance, S-E-R-E-N-A, he's never been translated. Let me see here. Who else? Oh, Jean Rouault, R-O-U-A-U-D. He's never been translated. He's also of Toussaint's generation, and he's a really great writer. Le Plaisio is a famous writer going back to the mid-60s in France. A really great writer. Never been published, I don't think, in translation in this country. I could go on all afternoon.
Well, we at least we got a couple of names out there.
Yeah.
Spread the word. Well, Jordan, thank you very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you, and I certainly appreciate translators much more than I did in the beginning. But thank you very much for your work.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't need to be appreciated that much. But as long as they allow me to translate books that I love, that's probably the only thing that really matters to me.
Gotcha. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Jordan.
All right, thank you. Colors bleed so black. Can't let go, then you're never coming back. You watch yourself when you talk to me. Cause I've got you an 86 TV.